Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The BBC and documentary producer Mike Rudin specifically in court in Sussex this week, accused of aiding and abetting terrorism. Funnily enough, we didn't hear about that on the BBC. With their deliberately misleading coverage of the 9/11 attacks, a possible sentence under that Terrorism Act 2000 is life in prison. Also, John Kerry, the new US Secretary of State, to replace Hillary Clinton. He gets the red carpet treatment at the Foreign Office on Monday. Does he think we don't know he's the same Skull and Bones club of which George Bush Jr. is a member? Plus, why the close links between the US and Nazi Germany at the end of World War II? Was it as simple as the two words, atom bomb? Plus, Martin Summers takes his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. But first this week, I'm joined by Pip Sherd. She's an advisor to Mayor Ferguson. In fact, when I invited her on the show, I thought she wasn't going to be an advisor to Mayor Ferguson, but she's back again on her transport advisory group. Hi, Pip. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi.
Now, can you tell us, first of all, what this is about, feeling that you had to step back from that for a little while a couple of weeks ago?
I was invited to be one of the five members of the Mayor's Advisory Group. We were having a discussion on bus rapid transit, which is, people who know me know this is a subject close to my heart, and I've been involved in the public inquiry. I believed that a decision had been made on this issue prior to the actual discussion at the group. I was very upset about that. It turns out, actually, I was misinformed, but I did actually resign for a brief period. But that was rather compounded by the fact that the media was sent my resignation, and it became a bit of a story. But within a week, I was back on the committee, because I think it's vitally important that there's independent people there who can be quite critical about the information that's being given by officers, so that we have choices in the city. And the main issue was about how many options there were for the bus rapid transit alternatives.
Now, what about you and your background? What makes you get excited about transport and want to actually change things?
Well, I come from it from an anti-road building stance. I've been a member of Friends of the Earth all my life, and I've spent my life fighting road proposals, particularly in the countryside. I was brought up on a farm, and I'm really trying to protect agricultural land from developments that I think are unenvironmental. And basically, I got involved about 6 years ago when we reformed the Friends of the Earth group, and we decided that the issue then was climate change, and one of the issues was road building. So I was at that time opposing the South Bristol Link Road, and then a lot of the schemes became bus rapid transit, which I think are equally rubbish and a waste of money, and I've developed my transport view since then.
Well, that's interesting, because a lot of the industry will put forward bus rapid transit as something really innovative, cutting-edge technology.
Well, that's the hype that you get from the consultants that have been working on the issue for the last 5 years. There's been vast amounts of money spent on schemes which are basically very roundabout buses. I mean, it's lots of money. We're getting something like £113 million from the government. We're putting nearly about £80 million ourselves in. But it's not really, the public don't get excited about it. It isn't going to be fast direct buses. It's not rapid, it's not comfortable. It's basically a bit of a pig in a poke. So we took it to public inquiry and persuaded the mayor that it certainly shouldn't run through the harbour, which was a major success so far. But now what we're trying to do is persuade the mayor to go on a different route and to add things to it, like cycle routes and an interchange at Temple Meads, actually turn it into what we call integrated transport.
Now, there's a sort of opportunity at Temple Meads, isn't there, because the big building's been knocked down there, to actually get more buses in. This is one of the things that always seems to be me a bit confusing, is why we don't have some sort of bus terminal rather closer to the railway station. It's almost like, you know, because that is a transport, it should be a transport hub with the half-hourly trains backwards and forwards to London.
Absolutely. If you go to any sort of city that knows how to do transport in a way that we don't, you find that basically there's a bus rail cycle interchange right outside the station. I don't think we need a new bus station. I think it's probably not as big as that, but the Mayor Ferguson has plans to turn the back of the station into a piazza, and my feeling is that it's great to do that, but basically it's a transport hub, so let's make sure we get decent transport.
What does he mean by a piazza? That sounds a bit Italian.
A public square. I think he has grand plans to remove the roundabout and do that at the back of Temple Meads, because now a lot of people come out the back of it into the friary, and basically create an entrance to the city right all the way to the centre. And basically he's got the idea of a boulevard, and I love that idea, because that will, you know, with trees and making it much more person friendly. But obviously I think of everything in terms of transport, so I want to make sure that, you know, that we do it, and we've got the money, and I think we should use the bus rapid transit money to do rail and proper buses.
Okay, now, one of the big bugbears on here, since you're a transport person, is the first bus. We're always hearing about, you know, sort of appalling tales of services from them, and also the way that they seem to constantly hike up the prices. They're quite happy, it seems, to have some kind of consultation and talk about things, but the prices still seem to be going up and up.
The difficulty we have is we don't have a transport authority. We haven't decided to work with the neighbouring authorities and take control of the whole bus network. In order to do that and to handle the power of first, we have to have a system that puts all bus companies on a level playing field. There's something like 12 bus companies in the city. They all ought to be treated the same. But at the moment, we've got a situation where first chooses services and we subsidise the unprofitable ones. What we need to do is to move much more towards a franchising system, as in London, where we can say to first, you know, these are the services that we want. This is how we want the run. At the moment, they decide the network. So basically, it's not going to be straightforward and simple to reduce fares. But what we have in this city is bus use declining. We have a model of bus use dropping and fares going up. It's sort of like a slowly going down the plug hole system. And what we need to do is to have it's a very complicated thing, but with a transport authority we would get back more control over the bus companies. We'd be able to do proper information. We would have cross ticketing. We need smart cards and all those things that make journeys seamless. So we don't have any of the good things that other authorities have got, so we must and we feel quite strongly that the transport, creating a transport authority would be what would start to turn the tide.
Well, I mean, I've heard talk of some sort of transport authority for probably 15 years or so. Yeah. What's stopping it happening?
It's the politics. It's the party politics and the territorial nature of the West of England.
Because George has said he's taking all of that out of the system now. No more party politics. So have you noticed any kind of change in, you know, the general sort of way that Bristol is working with neighbouring authorities?
Well, on a transport authority, I think it's a difficult one, because the first step towards the transport authority is for two of the four councils to get together and undertake a review of how we're doing on transport.
So are we talking about North Somerset, South Gloucestershire, Bath?
It could be any of them. Okay. I think the two logical ones, obviously, if Bristol and South Gloucester were together, that's great, because that's a built-up area. But if North Somerset will never do it, they've set their mind against it. But it could be Bristol and Bath, because if you look at the census results, the way Bristol and Bath are going is towards more sustainable transport, and where North Somerset and South Gloss are going is towards car dormitory status. So it doesn't really matter. It only requires two authorities to ask for a review to look at how we're doing on transport, which isn't well, to start the process. And I think if they were totally honest about where we're going and understood the way the public feel, we could start that process. The other possibility is that we go to Parliament and ask the government to do it for us. But basically, how badly we're doing has to be highlighted for people to acknowledge there's a need to do it. And George is very keen to do this, but he has to find another authority to work with him.
What about things like the congestion charge as well? Because that's another thing that's being talked about at the moment. I mean, call me conspiracy minded, but it seems to me that, you know, that there is deliberately nothing being done at the moment to really sort out congestion. That the whole problem with the tram over the last 10 years, or maybe 15 years, various forms of better public transport has led to the situation now where there is an opportunity, and some would see it as an opportunity, to introduce a congestion charge to charge people for doing this. Is creating an entirely new market, bringing one of these big companies like Capita in that run the congestion charge in London, and charging people to do what normally, you know, it's actually, you know, it's not the cheapest thing to do, to buy a car and drive around in it anyway, but there's what are your thoughts about whether that's going to happen you know, in the city as it has done in London?
Well, I think that the reason people do congestion charge is to make people think about their journeys, to make people think about the cost of their journeys, and also to raise income.
Well, the way people think about that, surely, Pip, is just how much it costs. If it's not going to cost them too much to get the bus into town, they'll do that. If it's going to cost, it's going to cost less in petrol to go a couple of miles in the car, they'll probably go in the car.
Absolutely. Well, it's I agree with congestion charging, and I know the mayor wants to look at that. But I think it's a bit further down the line. The first thing that he wants to do is to have a cross-city area residence parking scheme. And I think that would be vital to improve the economics of the park and ride sites and public transport. Because while people can drive into the city, park free, get a bike out the back of their car and not pay anything at all, they won't be using the parking, and they won't be using the park and ride sites, which we actually subsidise. So my feeling is that the whole issue of where is there free parking in the city has to be addressed first. And the residents' parking's worked very well in Kingsdown. It's now gone to Cottam. People love it when they've had it, and it's actually quite cheap. I mean, the cost of it compared to the cost of London. The advantages for people in those areas now are great. So that's one thing.
But the worry is for many residents is that this is another thing that they have to pay for parking outside their own house, for example. They've got to buy a sort of
charge is minimal. Ticket. It's about £30 a year.
What I was just coming to say was that once that charge starts, year after year, it's a very easy thing for the council then to just turn up the clock to make them pay more and more. And of course, they also need to pay if anyone comes to visit them. And this is just another thing that people have to come and pay for, which they don't want to have to pay for.
Well, no, of course they don't. But when what happens is those areas that get that scheme afterwards, the residents like it, if you see what I mean. So it actually works to reduce traffic in their areas. It reduces commuter parking, it reduces people parking on corners, and it makes the whole area less full of traffic at peak hours. And actually it only operates between Monday and Friday between 9 and 5, so weekends are free. And basically the charge is very low, and the scheme in Bristol as it's set up just covers the cost of enforcement.
Now, I mean, I live in St Paul's. St Paul's is like a giant great car park, basically, all over the place. And as you say, people parking on corners, so you might be able to go down a road, but when you want to turn left or right, you can't, because there's a car on the corner. You just have to keep going straight on, and there's a little gap, a tiny gap, to try and turn. I mean, for a start, it surprises me that the police don't actually come and stick tickets on these cars that park on the pavement. I mean, I suppose ultimately what I'm saying is, when are we going to get some sort of scheme in St Paul's to actually, you know, to sort out that whole situation?
Well, it's residence parking, because what you get with residence parking is enforcement officers that make sure that people don't. I mean, I've had discussions with officers about this, and I've said, look, you know, what do people get? I mean, actually, the charge is quite small, really, compared to places like London. And it is set up not to be profit-making. It was clear that it wasn't going to be a way of creaming off money. It was just a way of changing the economics of transport and improving communities where people want to walk and cycle, and they don't want a lot of traffic milling around at the times when they're going to school. So I do understand, but all cities that work there, where transport works well, whether it's Bath or London, where public transport works really well, have the sort of donut in the inner area of residence parking schemes. It is a vital bit of stopping people coming in, driving in from outside, and not using using public transport. You know, that is, it's a really, really important part of the transport infrastructure.
Okay, so old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, we're looking at a situation in now where Pip is saying there isn't really any kind of prospect of a transport authority in the near future, and First Bus have got to go through some sort of consultation over what they're doing over fares. Everybody is annoyed with them, it seems, that uses the service, partly through the reliability, but secondly, most importantly, is the simply the cost. It seems that, you know, the public transport system in the city is not set up for the people that live here. It's set up for the shareholders of First Group and the other big bus companies.
Well, and also, of course, it's become a kind of dog's breakfast, because there used to be, I mean, you know, back in the day in the 1940s or 1950s, there would have been a municipal.
Well, it was the Bristol
system.
It was the Bristol Omnibus Company.
The Bristol Omnibus Company. I mean, Seattle in the US, buses are free. People just hop on, hop off. I'm saying, well, you can't do that. So, yes, you can. But I think we could do that here, Pip's commitment to trying to change things for the better, and I think a lot of the things that are being suggested sound very good to me, but we are a long way behind where we should be.
Anyway, Martin, what's the economics of somebody charging nothing for public transport at all?
Well, you have to subsidise it, but of course we're subsidising stuff anyway. I mean, First Bus, the connecting stuff and out into the suburbs and the local villages, that's the stuff that has to be subsidised. And of course, ultimately, a transport system for a city is like its lifeblood, and if you just allow it to sort of develop as a kind of cancerous growth without any kind of plan, then you end up with the kind of mess that we've got. And the philosophy behind that is wrong. You've got to have an overall plan, and that's exactly what we've been lacking, because we don't believe in plans.
We have the same bus system as the rest of the country. The only bus system that's different is London. The politicians didn't muck around with... When the Conservatives changed the whole bus system, they didn't muck around with London.
No.
They had a system in London where Transport for London decides what the network's going to be, and then all the bus companies compete with each other to tender for the route. They take the revenue. Due to their size, they can work much more effectively. The rest of the country got saddled with a system where the network is basically worked out by private bus operators, and those became big operators. So First took, you know, made sure other companies didn't really survive. Mm. What we've got to do in this city is to actually build the small bus companies. And you will find that the smaller bus companies and Wessex will in time, because they have models of bus growth, will in time, if given the right level playing field, start to compete with First Bus. But it's a very complicated structure. I mean, the main thing actually is to get more people onto public transport, and the best way of doing that is to get smart cards and ticketing and to get proper structured fares that encourage people to travel more frequently. And that's the other thing that I'm hoping the mayor will deal with, that we'll get smart cards sometime this year, and that is one of my priorities. And I think it's a question of getting all the bus companies together and making sure that they all take part, because there's now 12.
Yeah, but this is a bit of a problem, a bit like with the local authorities for the transport authority. How do you actually bang those heads together? And that seems to be the difficulty, Pip. Do you think it's going to be any better under Mr. Ferguson than it has been in the past? Because you've been doing this for quite a while now, this transport campaigning.
Well, I've done different things. I mean, I've done anti-roads campaigning. I've campaigned twice for a tram and been turned down. That's the politics. I now know what I think we need in the city, and I think actually it's a combination of improvements on all fronts. I will do my level best, and I think it's a long haul for transport, to actually make sure that the real things that are going to get our kids onto buses, which I think is the whole smart card ticketing thing, is something that happens. You know, that is a priority. And in transport, if you start succeeding, people start believing. And we have to get more people on the buses. Without a doubt, we do. And the buses are actually slower than they were since they built the Greater Bristol Bus Network. I mean, how did that happen?
Well, I'll tell you why, it's because the fares have gone up and more people are using their cars.
Well, we have to, I mean, partly it's to do with enforcement, partly to do with design, but I mean, we really, you know, we can't have a situation where the buses are slower. But, you know, you can only do what you can do, and I think it's important to prioritise.
Now, you talked just now also about quick wins, because a lot of things you're talking about are kind of more long-term, but what the mayor is looking for in his period of office is these quick wins. So there's a little bit of a tension there, isn't there, between what the officers and the mayor are looking for and what you're looking for?
Well, there's a lot of things that can be done quite simply to improve the passenger experience, because a lot of people tried buses and they didn't like them for some reason that's not always major. I mean, my feeling is that I start from where we are, but I look 10 years ahead. My view is that we should have a metro like Merseyrail, that we should have a local controlled rail network run by a transport authority with trams on it, basically, in about 10 years' time. But it's how you get there. I mean, I've got a vision, but transport has to be planned in 10-year visions. George has only got 3.5. But I think if George starts on the right steps, and the good thing about not being a party politician is you're not hidebound by the party politics. You haven't got baggage. You can look at things in a way that actually is new. And he actually comes from a European type of perspective as to where transport's better. So I think that what I'll be saying to him is, George, concentrate on the things that really are going to get more kids onto the buses. You know, talk to your youth mayors. What is it they want? You know, and start putting pressure on the bus companies to do what the city want, and throw your weight around a bit and get the other three councils to do the same, because they all have a very hands-off approach. I mean, it's unbelievable. If it was me, I'd be jumping up and down and banging on the door every day. And First Bus's review is a joke, because it's just First Bus. You know, the whole network needs reviewing, you know, and we need a growth plan for buses. And once we start changing the way buses look and the way we do ticketing, people will start to believe it might improve. You know, I mean, it's a long haul, but you know, I've got some pretty clear plans myself.
Okay, I'm just about to say goodbye, but I suddenly think, hang on, what about these bonkers bus stops? This is the bus stops that have been moved in these so-called, priority routes or something, out into the middle of the road, which stop all the cars, and then you get the cyclists having to go out into oncoming traffic to go past them. That just seems to me to be one of the craziest things I've ever seen, and apparently we got a First Bus got an award for it, because it's so dangerous. If people are going past a bus when it's right out in the middle of the road, whether they're in a car or on a bicycle, surely yeah. That's dangerous.
Are we talking about the Old Market here?
No, I'm talking about up fish ponds, for example. In fact, quite a few routes in the city have now had this thing where a load of builders have come in, they've got the bus stop on the side of the road, and they've built the bus stop out a sort of bus width into the road. So when the bus stops, it stops all the traffic, which is good for the bus, but it's actually...
That's a crazy system, yeah. I mean, to be honest, the Greater Bristol Bus Network, there are so many problems with it, with bus lanes that aren't it good, and cyclists being cut up, and you know, it the engineering wasn't perfect, and that's one of the things that the city should be honest about. Did we do it right? And if it's wrong, let's change it. I mean, it really is, you really need to look at the before and the after of things, and nobody looks at the after. They just get the money for the before and then forget about the after. And we do have to be doing things that work.
Well, Pip Sherd, you're Bristol Mayor Ferguson's Transport Advisory Group, an unpaid, unofficial voluntary advisor. Sounds like you could do the job better than most of them. But anyway, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Now, Alexander Litvinenko's murder, the government has been accused of a cover-up this week. The British government was accused of colluding with the Russians to cover up vital evidence in the murder of Alexander Litvinenko at a pre-inquest hearing into the former KGB agent's death today. Martin, can you just go into this whole business of Litvinenko? He's the guy who was poisoned with polonium, isn't he?
Yes, and his book, which is very interesting to read, is called Blowing Up Russia. Blowing Up Russia. He wrote it with Yuri Feltinsky before he died. And basically, he was an FSB agent, and the FSB are the...
This is the Russian Secret Service,
yeah. Which basically, it's KGB, you know, the modern version of the KGB. And the allegation in his book was that in September 1999, all these bombs went off in Moscow and Ryazan and other places, killing hundreds of innocent people, blamed on the Chechens, but in actual fact was carried out by the Russian security forces. And that's the main allegation in Litvinenko's book.
So, I mean, it does look as if Putin may have a Russian leader, may have a motive. Has anyone else have a motive for killing Alexander Litvinenko?
Well, I think what's interesting about this is that the government doesn't really want to delve into it. And I think the reason why the British and other governments don't really want to delve into this is because they probably know very well that it was the Russian security forces who carried out those attacks. But if they start accusing the Russians of carrying out false flag terrorism in order to sort of manipulate politics in Russia, then the Russian response is going to be, what about you? What about 9/11? What about 7/7? That's your security services blowing people up in order to manipulate politics in your country. So they don't want to open that can of worms.
Now, the inquest was due to start in May, but now may have to be delayed, the hearing was told. So this is really all being pushed by the Foreign Office. They want to keep a lot of the information secret. Why can't they just be open about it?
Because if we're open about this and look into it properly, it's quite likely that we'll all draw the conclusion that Litvinenko was murdered. Litvinenko may not have been murdered by Putin. There are other suspects. But the point is, his main allegations about the Russian security forces carrying out false flag terrorist attacks on Russian soil. The problem with that is that the Western security forces have been doing this for years as well. The Bologna bomb in 1980, it's very clear that was carried out by Western intelligence services. So, in other words, if we start accusing the Russians of manipulating politics through planting bombs, their response to that is going to be, yes, but you manipulate your politics through planting bombs, and that's a can of worms nobody wants to open.
Okay, also this week, why should taxpayers, this is in the US, give big banks $83 billion a year? Interviews and meetings with investors, executives of the biggest US banks, JP Morgan Chase, and Chief Executive Jamie Dimon, make the case that size is a competitive advantage. It helps them lower costs. So what if we told you that by our calculations, the largest US banks aren't really profitable at all? What if the billions of dollars they allegedly earn for their shareholders were almost entirely a gift from US taxpayers? Well, I imagine the same is true in the city, Martin.
It is. I mean, basically, the bailouts of the financial sector have allowed the banks to pretend that they're making a profit so that bonuses can be paid and shareholders can be paid off. In actual fact, they're being kept afloat by the taxpayer. But the taxpayer's running out of money, and that's why they're going to crash.
Is this why we keep hearing about services closing down? Because all that money that would be going to those services is now going to keep propping the banks up?
Yes, basically what's happened is that the resources for public goods have been snaffled by these private interests and used. I mean, basically, they've stolen it. And the other problem is that they then demand austerity in order to get, every penny that they claim that they're owed. But that, of course, then crashes the economy or pushes the economy down. And at that point, you get the stock market going up, the economy going down. That's classic crash territory.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, Tony Rook has represented himself at Horsham Magistrates Court in Sussex this Monday. TV licence evader refused to pay because the BBC covered up facts about 9/11 and claimed the tower fell 20 minutes before it did. Now, this is a bit of an audacious legal action. Rook says he's withholding his licence fee under Section 15 of the Terrorism Act 2000. This states it's an offence for someone to provide funds used for terrorism and aiding and abetting terrorism, effectively.
Yes, and he did a good job of getting it into court. I mean, various expert witnesses were going to be called, including Nils Harriet from Copenhagen University, who's a physicist who has, in peer-reviewed journals, proved that nanothermite was to be found in the rubble of the World Trade Center, which is, in fact, a high-level military explosive, which again brings us back to Litvinenko. It's not just the Russians who go around blowing things up and pretending it was somebody else.
Now, the point here being that the BBC's programmes actually about the 9/11 attacks, what Tony Rook is saying, Rooke, is that he doesn't want to give money to an organisation which is funding terrorism, because he says that the programmes that the BBC had done, particularly the ones around 9/11 made by Mike Rudin and his team at the BBC, a particular documentary team, what they've done is essentially slanted the evidence about 9/11 to make it look as if the official story is true, where actually there are some quite important holes in that story. What do you think about, first of all, the righteousness of his case? I mean, because this is, I mean, is it possible that the BBC are actually helping terrorism here?
Well, the purpose of the case is to draw attention to the situation, and the fact of the matter is that the BBC's coverage of the 9/11 issue has been entirely inadequate and in some cases deliberately misleading.
That's a bit of an accusation. Whereabouts deliberately misleading?
Well, for example, on the day of the attack itself, a BBC journalist, whose name I've forgotten, told
Jane Stanley,
yes,
I think,
she was speaking to camera, and she said, "We've just been told that a third building has collapsed, WTC 7, and a third building has collapsed." In fact, the building itself was in shot behind her and had not collapsed, but 20 minutes later it did, and it had no plane crashing into it. And this was the BBC. Now, this wasn't the BBC getting it. I mean, BBC had presumably been told by some security geek in New York, oh, this building is going to collapse, and then of course it did. But that
it's not because the BBC were in on it, it's just because they were being misled. But in subsequent coverage, they didn't point out, well, hang on a minute, they didn't look into that, they didn't ferret out any further information. Hang on, we were misled there by somebody who knew the building was going to collapse. How come they knew that the building was going to collapse if it was an accident? Because, of course, it wasn't an accident. All three buildings were wired with nanothermite. That is pretty much established.
Well, this was on the Daily Mail website, but it didn't actually appear in the newspaper, which is a bit of a bizarre one, isn't it? Usually, all the articles that are written for the Daily Mail on their website will appear either in the This Is Money section or on the Mail on Sunday or in the Daily Mail newspaper.
Well, I mean, the problem is that all over the media, and it's not just the BBC, people have a desire to keep their jobs, and messing with what the editors and the advertisers and the government want you to say is a way to lose your job, so everybody keeps mum. Same thing goes on in Russia. How much discussion do you think there is about whether the government bombed Moscow or not? Not a lot. The same goes on over here. We don't get told everything that's going on.
And Tony Rook is from a police family. He's certainly his father, I think his uncle as well, was a policeman. So he felt that it was really important to make this. He was asked to pay £200 costs, but didn't get forced to actually pay the licence fee itself. So where does the campaign to get the BBC to, I suppose, atone for its inaccuracies over its 9/11 reporting go from here?
Yeah, well, I mean, the way the court case played out, I understand from speaking to people who were there, was that the judge, who was only a local magistrate, said, look, I mean, you've got a case here, and you've brought all of these expert witnesses, but we're not in the business of listening to all of that. This is about TV licences. But because you've got a case, I am not going to force you to pay the licence. I'm just going to make you pay the court costs for your appearance and give you a conditional discharge. So, in other words, the magistrate was saying, look, you've got a case here, and I'm not going to punish you because you're not paying your licence, but basically, you've got to pay for the afternoon. You know, we've had a court session here and it's cost us £200 and you've got to pay for that. That's because, in actual fact, a lot of the evidence that was going to be brought forward was accurate, was from senior. I mean, you know, Tony Farrell, who used to be a police intelligence agent. We've got Nils from Copenhagen University. And, you know, the magistrate recognised that there was a case, but he said, we're not going to hear it, but we're not going to punish you by making you pay the TV licence. So it was a kind of rather judicious decision by the magistrate.
District Judge, she wasn't a magistrate, District Judge Stephen Nichols said, this is not a public inquiry into 9/11. This is an offence under Section 363 of the Communications Act. But, I mean, as we know, if you're, you can use as a perfectly legitimate defence that you were committing a minor offence to stop a greater crime.
Well, he seems to have accepted that because he didn't order Tony Rook to pay his licence fee. He just ordered him to pay £200 costs for the court appearance. And Tony, I think, is considering whether he's going to pay the licence fee or go, you know, or carry on having court cases and bringing witnesses and so on. So it's legal attrition by the 9/11 activists who have pushed this forward.
Now, one of the aspects of this, of course, is Osama bin Laden. He is the bogeyman or the real person who carried out 9/11. What do you think is the evidence for whether bin Laden was really behind the 9/11 attacks?
I think bin Laden, as we all know, and nobody disputes this, was working very closely with the CIA in the 1980s. There's pictures of him standing right next to Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was Carter's top advisor on foreign policy. Now, I ask people, say, at what point do you think Osama bin Laden stopped working for the CIA? Now, the official story is that he stopped working for the CIA during Gulf War I because infidels had been allowed onto the land, the sacred land of Saudi Arabia. And I put it to you that in actual fact, bin Laden, probably dead, not killed in Pakistan, died a long time ago, bin Laden possibly always was a CIA agent, and many of these extremist groups out there are in fact being run by the CIA. So I was reading earlier that some jihadi fighters from northern Syria are being withdrawn to Turkey to be sent to Mali. It's a funny old world, isn't it?
Well, another related to the BBC story, seven myths about the Iraq War, how BBC Newsnight failed journalism on the 10-year anniversary of the invasion. This is by Nafiz Ahmed. But before we go to that, we're going to hear Marina Morris, who's been out on the streets asking you about bin Laden particularly. And 2 years ago, when the US announced that they had captured and killed bin Laden in a very exciting and there's also been films made about it too, over in Abbottabad in Afghanistan, they finally tracked him down. But what did you think about that particular story?
Do you believe the official story of the death on Osama bin Laden?
There are always going to be different conspiracy theories, but from the information available and what I've heard, I'd have to say, as far as I believe, he is dead.
Well, I think they went in and shot him, didn't they? Yeah, so I believe what they told me for that.
I believe he's dead. There's just a lot of hearsay in it, really. It's like someone told someone, you know, it's like Chinese whispers, so... Yeah.
Yes, I believe it is death. He's not a good man, but because I am Muslim, but I don't like the terrorist Muslim. But Islam never support the terrorism. But his time, all are gathering, Catholic, Christian, and Jewish, and Muslim, all are together living, peaceful living.
I'm from Brazil.
I do.
Yeah, I don't have no reasons to believe in the conspiracy. I do believe. I heard that today he was already dead, and some changes in... I would say that the basic story is right.
Can we trust the BBC and American media?
I tend to believe the BBC more than the American media. I believe the American media is more politically motivated from left to right, whereas I believe the BBC strives to try and be independent and to seek views from all political sides.
No, I don't tend to like the media much because they tend to inflate things a bit. I'd rather have the BBC than the American. Well, because it's British, I suppose. You just tend to believe your own, don't you?
You can't really. They show everyone everything. Yeah. You could just be tricked into thinking and believing certain stories, but America's got a good... We've just got someone who's not good at all. They didn't get the priorities right.
I like the BBC. BBC is always the truth. Like America, but first priority is BBC.
I live in the United States as well for some time. I think overall the BBC is more trustful. I think BBC is more neutral politically. In American media you have some channels that are definitely left-wing, others that are right-wing.
The war on terror can well be regarded as a natural state of affairs.
No, I don't believe it can never be believed to be a natural state of affairs. It's specific groups, etc., who want to take that particular attitude. I don't believe that's natural. Who can end it? Probably the most difficult question. I think more public, if they actually sort of lobby their MPs, etc., can have more of an influence. And I think the UN need to do more as well, not just particular countries. It needs to be directed from the UN as an international effort, not particular countries who are trying to take the lead.
No, it's not a natural state of affairs, obviously war, is it? Because it's man-made, it's people fighting against each other. So I think people ought to let every country run their own, do their own little bit and get on with it. They need to ask the people on the ground what their opinion is.
I think it's well over top. Take it for instance, the situation, the airport security. So it makes me believe why only airports were not train stations and everything else. I think there are economic interests behind that, for instance, people that sell security equipment. So it's just that why one and not the other ones. And in the end, just one thing, and in the end, I think that if the goal of the terrorism is to create terror, I mean, they are already winning because we are living in a situation of terror. I think we need to go back to the way we were living, stop paying attention. We've lived in this situation for sometimes before 9/11. We had terror events. Some happen after that, so why keep in this state? When is it going to end? What is the criteria that is going to say that, well, that's it, let's stop that. Bring the troops back and stop that.
Well, some real diverse views there. But Martin, first of all, the idea that he's dead, I don't think anyone's really disputing that. But what is the evidence that, if there is any, that he didn't die 2 years ago, that he was dead before that?
Well, if you actually look at the English language press in Pakistan, things like Dawn and other English language newspapers, it's widely disbelieved in Pakistan itself that the story that we've been given is correct. So, for example, just a basic thing, we were shown a photograph of the White House Situation Room while they were watching video footage, supposedly, of the attack from cameras on the helmets of the SEALs involved in the attack. But they then had subsequently admit, well, actually, there was no video feed, and we actually posed the picture.
Oh, this is right, because, of course, Bin Laden was killed in Pakistan, not Afghanistan, wasn't he?
Yes, of course.
And under the noses of the Pakistani government, who didn't really want it to, been asked
there are eyewitnesses from Abbottabad. It's named Abbottabad after the British Colonel Abbott, who created it in the 19th century. There are eyewitnesses who are in the area who are saying, well, actually, what happened was the helicopter that the Navy SEALs turned up in crashed into a wall, and they were all killed. And that's what eyewitnesses were saying. And we've heard three or four different versions from the White House about what supposedly happened. They can't seem to make their mind up what the chain of events was. And frankly, if you've captured or killed Bin Laden, why no photographs, why no DNA evidence?
It's because it's widely presumed inside Pakistan, and certainly inside the Pakistani military, that the whole operation was a basically a put-up job. The best information the Pakistani military have is that he died in Tora Bora because he had a major kidney problem, and the French Secret Services gave a press conference in November 2001 where they said, well, the CIA station chief in Dubai and the head of Saudi intelligence went to visit Osama bin Laden in hospital in Dubai on July the 4th, 2001. Now, what people have got to realise is that an awful lot of what goes on is psychological warfare. You are told what they want you to learn, what they want you to think, and it's all about manipulation.
Well, that's someone there said Chinese whispers.
Chinese whispers. And, of course, people like us who unpick all the propaganda, we get accused of being conspiracy theorists. And do you know what I say to that? What we're talking about here is military intelligence. General Gul, who used to head up the US, ISI in Pakistan, which is their main spy agency, he's quite clear 9/11 was carried out by the Americans. General Ivashov, who was commander of the Russian armed forces on 9/11, he's on the internet saying quite clearly, inside job. So we've got the head of the Pakistani Secret Service, the head of the Russian armed forces, we've got General Stubblebine in the US, Major General Stubblebine, we've got various other military officers for 9/11 truth. People should have a look at that. Top US military officers, only US military officers can belong to it, hundreds of them. We don't believe the story the government's telling us. And they are the military officers who are experts in this business.
Obviously, one of the big events in this whole war on terror since 2001 has been the invasion, many would say illegal invasion of Iraq, and the war crimes committed there. Nafees Ahmed has come up with quite a critique called Seven Myths About the Iraq War, How the BBC Newsnight Failed Journalism on the 10-year anniversary of the invasion. He's got these seven myths. The final one of those seven, the number of people who died as a consequence of the war, is disputed and will always be disputed. It could be anything from 100,000 to 500,000, but who knows? Well, Kirsty Walk from BBC's Newsnight characterised the number of Iraq War civilian casualties as an inherently disputed matter with no real resolution in sight. But this, says Nafees, just isn't true. There are serious scientific peer-reviewed estimates. The most rigorous epidemiological study of the Iraq civilian death toll was published in the leading peer-reviewed British medical journal, The Lancet, undertaken by Johns Hopkins University's Bloomberg School of Public Health. It estimated 655 excess Iraqi civilian deaths due to the war, Martin.
Yes, and the methods that were used in this study are exactly the kind of methods that they're using in Syria now to say that 40,000 have died. So Assad, the evil butcher, killed 40,000 of his own people, but Tony Blair killed 655,000 Iraqis using exactly the same methodology.
And the war on terror goes on. John Kerry, the new Secretary of State, was in London on Monday talking to the public alongside our Foreign Secretary, William Hague.
An appalling injustice is being done to the people of Syria, which the world cannot ignore. So we discussed the vital need for a political transition and our firm support for UN and Arab League envoy Lakhdar Brahimi. We agreed that for as long as a political solution to the conflict is blocked off, the international community has a responsibility to take steps to help prevent the loss of life in Syria. Loss of life including what the terrible loss of life that we have just witnessed in Aleppo.
That's Foreign Secretary William Hague there speaking on Monday at the Foreign Office. But he was also there alongside John Kerry, who had quite a lot to say about the whole situation in Syria.
And that is just the latest example of Assad's brutality. We condemn this indiscriminate killing of innocent civilians, and we condemn it in the strongest terms. And it is just further evidence that Assad has to go.
Now that's the new US Secretary of State, John Kerry. But John Kerry was interviewed about 10 years ago on American television about this organisation called the Skull and Bones Club, of which he's a member. And he was interviewed on US TV asking about, and they asked him about the same club, the Skull and Bones, which George Bush Jr. was also a member of.
You both were members of Skull and Bones, a secret society at Yale. What does that tell us?
Not much, because it's a secret.
Is there a secret handshake? Is there a secret code?
I wish there were something secret I could manifest.
322, a secret number?
There are all kinds of secrets, Tim, but one thing is not a secret. I disagree with this president's direction that he's taking the country. We can do a better job, and I intend to do it.
And we'll be watching. Be safe on the campaign trail. John Kerry, thanks for joining us. And we'll be right back.
Well, that's John Kerry appearing about 10 years ago on US TV, Martin, talking about being a member of the same Skull and Bones club at Yale University as George Bush, the guy he was running against.
Yeah, it's a sort of their equivalent, the Bullingdon Club. But of course, it's not just ex-Eton for them. John Kerry's a supposed Democrat, but he's in it the same as George Bush.
What about his record with the Iran-Contra? Because he was in charge of the Iran-Contra hearings, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. In actual fact, he did a reasonable job of uncovering half of what was going on, or a fraction of what was going on. I think the most interesting thing about Kerry was that in actual fact he did win against George Bush, and many people were saying that he should contest the vote rigging that had been going on. But because he's a Skull and Bones man, he probably decided to throw in the towel because of the fact that he's part of the establishment, and he's now getting his reward by giving the job of Secretary of State by Obama years later. He's a safe pair of hands with a slightly liberal tinge to his politics.
Now, this organisation, Skull and Bones, is a pretty spooky one, and just about 4 years ago, the BBC, actually, along with American networks, ran an interview with Mr. Rosenbaum. He was a US journalist who had secretly recorded, along with a woman assistant, one of these initiation rites on the Yale University campus into the Skull and Bones, and we're going to play that now. It's a rare thing to broadcast, but I would say if you're someone of a bit of a nervous disposition, or if you've got kids around, it might be a good idea to switch the radio down for a minute or so as we broadcast this little bit of footage of, or it was actually filmed at the time and broadcast on television in the US and Britain, about what is actually involved in the initiation of someone into the Skull and Bones Club, of which the new Secretary of State for the United States, John Kerry, is a member.
So that's where they have the ceremonies in
the outdoor part of it. Part of it was indoor, so we only got to see the outdoor part.
Right.
We only got to listen to the outdoor part. God only knows what went on indoors.
And what did you hear? What was it? You managed to get this unique.
Oh, it was disgusting. It was gross. I mean, they were pretending to murder people.
What was the tone of it, though? Was it jokey?
Vicious.
Or was it quite?
No, it wasn't jokey at all. It was sick. In fact, the only way I can describe it was sick.
Get the war now!
What you're hearing is the first recording ever made of the Skull and Bones initiation ceremony. It has never been broadcast before. Fifteen new members of the club are being introduced into the macabre rituals of Skull and Bones by the senior students who are about to graduate. The club has what some might see as a strange fascination with death, skulls and bones. There's the chants too, difficult to hear first of all, but including the devil equals death and death equals death. These rituals have been honed over centuries, giving the society a weird set of traditions, rules and secrets. For example, initiates are known as neophytes, outsiders are called barbarians, and the number 322 is sacred.
Well, the devil equals death, death equals death. Do you think it's a good idea to have the man who's in charge of the biggest nuclear arsenal the world's ever known in such a club, Martin?
No, and I think the fact of the matter is, if Skull and Bones didn't exist, they'd have to invent it. They need things which tie the elite together, basically partners in crime. It's like joining La Cosa Nostra, and these kinds of ceremonies are all part of the process of binding the elite together, so that when push comes to shove and countries have to be invaded and false flag terrorism events have to be orchestrated, those in the know are in the know, and they've got the networks necessary to do what they need to do.
Now, what about the rights and wrongs, though, of his expressed, I mean, he's basically now saying that he wants to initiate more help for the rebels in Syria. Also, possibly, the US and Obama are talking about attacking Iran in June, according to Israeli media reports this week.
Well, that's right, and don't forget that they've been supporting the Syrian rebels all along. The Saudis and the Qataris have been doing a lot of the dirty work, but I understand from reading some, I think it was in the Daily Express, that British special forces are in there. It's basically saying you've got a war going on, and we are supporting various factions in that war, but therefore we want to bring peace to Syria. Assad makes exactly the same assertion. You know, I'm the government, I want to bring peace to Syria, but first we've got to kill these terrorists. And of course, we're not talking about Yemen, where all sorts of people are dying all the time, but we're not getting excited about that, why ever not? And we're not talking about Saudi Arabia, who are actually supporting most of the terrorists all over the planet, including in Mali. Why aren't we invading Saudi Arabia? Oh, hang on, they're our allies. Oh, hang on, that's where most of the Al-Qaeda are based. Oh, hang on a minute, all these Al-Qaeda people are actually working with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, working with NATO intelligence. Hang on. It's not what it seems. Nothing's what it seems. If we're going to have armed uprisings and we're going to support armed uprisings, what about an armed uprising in Bahrain and against the people who are running the Saudi Arabia? What about an armed uprising there? Oh, no armed uprising there. We've got to support legitimate government and work for change peacefully. Like hell.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Well, on the more positive side, he lives in Bristol. His name is Enrique Ribeiro. He's a son of the little-known 1974 Portuguese Revolution. Martin, tell us a little bit about that revolution. Little-known, I say, because we hardly ever hear about it, do we?
No, I mean, the Salazar dictatorship had been in power in Portugal since 1926, so it was a, you know, very, very long-lived fascist dictatorship. And the army, basically, which was a civilian, a conscript army, the officers in the army, the movement of the captains, overthrew the dictatorship in 1974 and brought in democracy.
Well, I interviewed Enrique this week, and it was on the Dialect programme, which goes out went out this afternoon at 2 o'clock. You can pick up the podcast, and it's on again the second half of the interview in two weeks on Friday afternoon. So let's have a little listen to that, a bit of clip from that now.
Granddad had the two major revolutionaries living with him and didn't realize. He wanted to put, because he was a political police, he wanted to put gasoline for free on his car because it was his right. And my uncle snapped his card from the hand and put it away and said to him, "Dad, all that Dad learned today is gonna change. Look." And the people came to the street, and the army is on the street. This happened at night. My father and my uncle, on the morning, they were taking the breakfast with my granddad. So on the night, they had the big action of the infiltration. Then the army that is with them is on the street. The government tried to fight back. The Navy threatens, and this is funny because how the thing is, how random it is, that they send a fragata, that is a boat, a cruiser, yeah, with that big canyons, to the river, and the sergeant that is on the bridge, when they give authorization to shoot against the population, the sergeant take the weapon and put the weapon on the head of the commandant of the ship and says, "No, we don't gonna shoot civilians. He is my godfather."
Well, it's very much close to many of the people in Portugal involved in that, Martin. Just quickly, what was the sort of role? This was a fascist dictatorship, and there was a military coup to overthrow it.
Yeah, there was a military coup to overthrow it because a younger generation of officers decided that they were going to put an end to the dictatorship, and they plotted very cleverly to do it, and they did it without actually killing anybody. You know, we were talking earlier about uprisings in Syria or whatever. It was all done without bloodshed at all. It's called the Revolution of the Carnations because it was a peaceful change.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, we have no show next week. The ladies take over for the day, so just to show men can contribute to next week's Women's Day, I've got an interview now with the author of one of the most important books to come out this year, about women and by a woman. I offered next Friday's coordinator, Shivani Sarah Fox, this interview for International Women's Day, but was told it wasn't wanted. The book is Shadow Lives, The Forgotten Women of the War on Terror, out last week, and the author is former features editor from The Guardian, Victoria Britton.
My name's Victoria Britton. I'm a journalist, and I've come to Froome to talk about the war on terror and media and lies, and to promote my new book, which is called Shadow Lives, The Forgotten Women of the War on Terror. And what I'm trying to show in the book is a very small corner of the war on terror, which nobody else has really looked at, which is talking to women in Britain whose husbands were either in Guantanamo or in prison or in control orders, house arrest here in Britain. And I think the kind of erosion of civil liberties in Britain, which is one of the fallouts of the war on terror, is something that people haven't really thought enough about. And these women, these families, who are, incidentally, despite the terrible time they've had, incredibly strong and interesting and generally role models, I think it gives us a new way of thinking about the war on terror. I'll give you one example of a friend of mine. She is originally from Senegal, and she's French, and she's married to an Algerian. And her husband was one of those caught up in the fishing net after 9/11, when 12 foreign Muslim men were put in prison and kept there for 2 years without trial, until the House of Lords ordered that they be released. And in that time, her husband tried twice, tragically, to kill himself and ended up in a wheelchair. But Josephine is the most positive person you can possibly imagine. And she has seen her husband through this and through the isolation of living on a control order with no visitors. When I first visited her, I didn't yet have Home Office permission to visit, and I would sit in the street outside her house while she sat inside, chatting cheerfully and giving me coffee and biscuits and playing with the children. And it was an example of resilience that I just loved.
That was Victoria Britton, author of Shadow Lives, The Forgotten Women of the War on Terror. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. You can follow my Twitter feed in between shows at Tony Gosling. A podcast of this show is available just after broadcast. The website, thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very relaxing and enjoyable two weekends.
National news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, a court has heard a fire investigator say that petrol...